WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone is going to be back next week. I'm Michael Loewinger.
Support for KQED comes from Comcast Business. When choosing Comcast Business Internet, customers are choosing a next-generation 10G network to help keep their business future-ready. Comcast Business, powering possibilities. Restrictions apply. Leif Cabraser, Hyman, and Bernstein seeking justice for the injured, victims of fraud, whistleblowers, employees, and investors in the Bay Area and nationally for over five decades. Online at lchb.com. Coming up on the Sunday Music Drop today, we'll hear the song Things Can't Go On Like This Forever from San Francisco dance music producer Chrissy. He'll be performing at Mothership Bar in San Francisco on June 22nd. The Sunday Music Drop, our series on local musicians with upcoming shows, and you can hear it this afternoon at 5:35. Good afternoon, I'm Sandy Althaus, and you're listening to KQED-FM San Francisco, KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento, and the time is 3 p.m.
There's a basic question in economics that's really hard to answer. How do you spend money to help people rise out of poverty? Well, what if you just gave them cash, no strings attached?
They'll have more money in their pockets, money to pay for school fees or food or to buy a cat.
I'm Dave Blanchard. Today on Planet Money, we go to Kenya to talk to people who were given cash, and we discover how a cow might be a better bank than a bank.
And I'm Guy Raz. Today on How I Built This, we meet a man who believes that a radically different approach to construction might hold the key to creating more affordable housing.
What I hope to see in my own lifetime with my own eyes is the end of the global housing crisis.
It's an hour of economics and innovation on How I Built This.
And Planet Money from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. In Israel, the far right wing of the government is rejecting a Gaza ceasefire proposal that President Biden announced on Friday. NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Tel Aviv, where senior Israeli cabinet ministers are threatening to topple the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu if the ceasefire proposal is adopted.
President Biden said Israel was offering Hamas a six-week ceasefire and an exchange of Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners. Biden said the ceasefire would then lead to a permanent end of hostilities. An Israeli official confirmed to NPR that Israel proposed this deal privately, but that Israel would not commit to extending the ceasefire past 6 weeks. The official was not authorized to speak publicly about the sensitive ceasefire negotiations. Biden's revealing of the ceasefire proposal has caused a political firestorm in Israel. Far-right members of Netanyahu's cabinet said Israel must destroy Hamas before ending the war, and they threatened to resign if the ceasefire deal is advanced. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Ukraine's president says the U.S. should allow his troops to strike Russian military targets with long-range American weapons. NPR's Joanna Kikissis reports he made the comment in Singapore, where he accused China of blocking support for a Ukrainian peace plan.
Last week, the White House announced that it will allow Ukraine to use U.S.-supplied weapons to hit military targets in Russia, but only across the border from northeastern Ukraine. In Singapore, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russia is using long-range weapon systems along other parts of the border to continue attacking Ukraine.
So they have these weapons there and they do not remove them because they know that Ukraine cannot target them with Western weaponry, even if they fire against us.
The White House has been reluctant to allow Ukraine to use long-range U.S. weapons like ATACMS to avoid being drawn into a direct confrontation with Russia. Joanna Kikissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
Police in Akron, Ohio are investigating an overnight shooting that left one person dead and 24 others injured. Zaria Johnson with member station IdeaStream Public Media has more.
The Akron Police Department says calls came into the 911 center just after midnight, reporting multiple gunshots and wounded victims near Kelly and 8th Avenues on the city's east side. A firearm and several dozen shell casings were recovered at the scene. U.S. Representative Amelia Sykes from Akron encouraged community members to reach out to the police department with tips. In a statement, she said her office is prepared to assist in the investigation as needed. No additional suspect or victim information has been released at this time. For NPR News, I'm Zaria Johnson in Cleveland.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman. Weather conditions have improved significantly today for firefighters working to contain the Corral Fire south of the town of Tracy in San Joaquin County. CAL FIRE Battalion Chief Josh Silver says high winds yesterday made it difficult to create a perimeter around the fire.
With the weather change, fire effects have slowed tremendously. We do have a couple active hotspots. Those are mostly interior. With today's day resources that arrived, we have fresh crews out there engaged and really trying to turn the corner on this fire before we get into hotter, drier weather at the beginning of the week.
400 personnel, including tankers and helicopters, are on site dropping water on the fire. CAL FIRE says the blaze has charred over 14,000 acres and is 30% contained. About 170 homes near Tracy are without power today due to the fire. In a statement, a PG&E spokesperson said nearly 4,000 customers' homes were initially de-energized last night at the request of CAL FIRE officials to allow firefighters to safely battle the blaze. The spokesperson says utility crews patrolling lines affected by a separate outage found that the fire damaged PG&E equipment. Those repairs are expected to be completed today as safety allows. You can see pictures of the fire and read more about the people who have been affected by it at kqed.org. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman.
Support for NPR comes from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. For nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. And by the listeners of KQED. Tonight, partly cloudy, then mostly cloudy overnight with temperatures in the 50s to mid-60s. Tomorrow, it's going to be a mostly cloudy day around the bay. We'll still see some sunshine, highs from the 50s to the upper 60s, and then prepare. We're heading into a heat wave as we get into the middle of the week. Tomorrow in Sacramento, mostly cloudy, high temperatures from 81 to 89 degrees. It's 3:06. This is KQED Public Radio.
This is Planet Money from NPR.
There's this fundamental question in economics that has proven really hard to answer. How to spend money to help people out of poverty. The old school way of doing it was to fund programs that would support very particular things. Buying cows for a village, or giving people business training, or building schools.
But over the past few decades, there has been a new idea. What if the cure for people not having money was just giving them money, no strings attached? The argument for this idea is people know their own situation best. They can decide if they need a cow or training or a school. They just need some money.
This idea has spawned a whole new set of questions that economists are trying to answer. Like, if we do just give money, what's the best way to do that? Do you just give it all at once? Or do you dole it out over time, like through what's called a universal basic income? Well, a huge new study on giving cash was just released, and it's got a lot of answers. Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Dave Blanchard.
And I'm Amanda Aronchik. Today on the show, what have we learned about the best ways to give money to people who need it?
We go to Kenya and hear from gossipy neighbors. We find out what people spend their money on when there are no strings attached. And we discover how a cow might be a better bank than a bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BritBox, dedicated to helping people discover a world of British TV, including new original crime thriller After the Flood from the producers of Happy Valley, streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. This is NPR.
At Planet Money, we've been interested in this idea of just giving cash to people in poverty for a long time. We covered a major study that looked into this back in 2013. And at the time, the just give cash idea was still really novel.
The study was run by this nonprofit called Give Directly. Back then, they gave a few $100,000 to over 500 households in rural Kenya.
So, in today's episode, we're going to first listen back to our original reporting on that study from 2013. Then, in the second half of the show, we're going to hear about what we've learned since then.
In our original episode, Jacob Goldstein and David Kestenbaum traveled to Kenya. They visited one of the villages where some of the residents had received money.
To get to this one village, you drive on the main road past the sign that says Equator, because that's where the equator is. And then you turn off onto these increasingly rough dirt roads, and you have to stop and ask for directions. Eventually, you have to get out of the car and walk down a path. It's very green. There are trees and birds, little farm plots where people are growing corn. And then finally, by the side of the path, you find the guy who got the money on his phone.
Nokia.
This is Bernard Amundi. He's 25 years old. He's got two kids. He lives in a small house with mud walls, a dirt floor, and an old couch. There's no sink because there's no plumbing. There's no running water. There's no electricity. The way it all happened, he says, is that one day the village elder came by with some people he'd never met. They explained that they wanted to give him $1,000, which to him seemed like a very strange idea.
I had to be suspicious because in African setup, we believe somebody cannot give you such kind of huge money without working for it. Even our own president cannot give you. So I had to be suspicious.
But Amundi said, fine, I'm a poor man. You want to give me money? I'm not going to say no. The visitors gave him a cheap cell phone, and then a while later, he got the text message.
It was sent very early in the morning. I was still in my bed. I jumped up. My wife asked me, Bernard, what is it? Then I told her, the guys of Give Direct have sent us the money. It's here.
He still has the message on his phone.
Confirm you have received 41,000.
All over the village that morning, people were getting their first payment from Give Directly and having that jump out of bed experience. This is one of Bernard's neighbors, Daniel Otieno Ombok.
I got the message when I was in bed, and I told my wife, hey, you also read this message. She saw it and read, she burst into laughter. She laughed and told me, now, my husband, what do we do?
It's worth pointing out just how much money $1,000 is in this village. $1,000 is about what one of these families spends in an entire year. So you could think of it as someone coming up and offering to double your salary. But really, it's a much bigger deal than that. Most of the people in this village have no savings at all. So $1,000 is just this unimaginable sum. Daniel had never had this much money at once, nothing close to it.
So what do you do when more money than you've ever had in your life suddenly drops onto your cell phone? If you're Bernardo Mundi, you buy one of these.
This motorcycle is called Bajaj Boxer. It consumes low fuel.
The motorcycle cost him about $600. And this is not the kind of motorcycle you ride around so everyone will think you're cool. Around here, where most people live on dirt paths too narrow for cars, motorcycles are basically used as taxis. And Bernard bought his so he could become a taxi driver. It beat his old job. He used to work as a laborer. Often he would spend all day carrying heavy stones from one place to another. That's when he could find work. A lot of days there was no work at all. Now that he has his motorcycle, he says his work is much steadier. His kids used to go hungry, and they don't anymore.
People bought all kinds of things with the money. One family bought a little mill to grind corn for people in the village. Another started selling soap and cooking oil. Daniel Otieno Ombok, the other guy who jumped out of bed when he got the message, bought something he'd always wanted.
Mattress, high-density beds.
Mattress, high-density bed, it turns out, is basically just a mattress. He used to sleep on a mat on the ground.
Now I look like a human being. I'm not a human being.
What were you before?
John Inango. John Inango. Before I was an image of a human being, but in real sense I wasn't a human being.
The thing that really changed his life, he says, was the new roof. Daniel bought a metal roof to replace his old one, which was made of grass. He showed it to us. And if buying a new roof sounds like something that's nice to have but isn't really going to help Daniel in the long run, you've probably never owned a grass roof. Just about everyone we talked to had replaced their grass roofs with metal ones.
I was just very happy. I was very happy about the man.
This is Carolyn Adiambo, who also bought a metal roof and who explained why everyone was doing it. First of all, grass roofs are terrible roofs. They leak, failing to perform what is arguably the single most important job of any roof. When it rains, everything you own gets wet, it's hard to sleep, you have to keep moving around to find a dry spot. But also, grass roofs need to be constantly maintained. You have to keep replacing the grass, and apparently, you can't just cut any grass from the field. You need a special kind of grass, and often, you have to pay for it.
The grass is very expensive because you have to buy grass every year, even three times. Yeah, and it costs a lot.
A metal roof costs more up front, $200 or $300, but it can last for more than 10 years, and in the long run, it's way cheaper than a grass roof. So buying that metal roof means that every year, Carolyn and the others won't have to spend money buying new grass. It's like they just boosted their income for the next decade. They'll have more money in their pockets, money to pay for school fees or food or to buy a cow.
And buying a cow, that was also really common.
Oh, yeah. That's your cow.
I named her Apala.
It's a female cow, a very good one because it produces milk.
A lot of milk.
Daniel told us his cow cost about $400. He says it produces 2 liters of milk a day. His family drinks 1 liter and sells 1 liter for about 50 cents. Carolyn also bought a cow, but she says don't think of it as a cow. Think of hers as a bank.
The cows are just like bank. Yeah. When we put there, it's just as if we have saved it on the cow.
And why buy a cow instead of putting the money in the bank?
In the bank. You know, money in the bank, sometimes you can just go and take it small, until it got finished.
A cow, on the other hand, you can't fritter away a few shillings at a time. If you want to get your money out of a cow, you have to take your cow to market and sell it.
All these things people spent money on, cows, roofs, a motorcycle, they seem like reasonable choices. In fact, they seemed so reasonable, we started to worry that people were just telling us the good news stories. So we asked a different question. Not what did you do with the money, but what did your neighbors do?
And then we started to hear different stories. Bernard told us, sure, I spent the money well, but not everybody did.
There's so many guys who are very careless, and I know as you're going to walk around in some homes, you're going to see guys who misuse their money. You'll get that some of them didn't even put up a house.
They
didn't even buy a motorcycle. Some of them are still staying in their garage houses. Yeah, you'll just see there's no change in his life, and they misuse the money.
What did they do with the money?
Some of them are drunkards, so they probably use it to buy alcohol. Others just spend the whole amount on food. They just ate and became fat, and there's nothing to see. Nothing has remained of it.
Bernard didn't name anyone in particular, but another guy in the village, a guy named Julius, said, "My neighbor, right over here, look. He still has a thatch roof on his house. He wasted his money. He was so embarrassed, he didn't even want to talk to you."
He saw your vehicle, and he knew that you were around. He decided to run away. They're nowhere now.
So we went to the neighbor's house, and just like Julius said, he wasn't home. There were two little kids there who told us that their parents had gone into town.
It seemed like Julius might be right. So we asked GiveDirectly about the neighbor. And a woman named Lydia Tala, who works for GiveDirectly and is from the region, managed to reach him on the phone the next day. He told her he wasn't hiding and he wasn't embarrassed. He said his first wife had died. He wanted to get remarried. But in this part of Kenya, the groom traditionally has to pay the bride's family. So that's what he spent the money on. He spent it on a dowry so he could get remarried. And that's why he still had a thatched roof.
That was Jacob Goldstein and David Kestenbaum back in 2013. And in the years since that study, giving cash unconditionally to help people out of poverty has become more common for development economics. Critics used to worry that the money would be wasted by the recipients, but in part because of this very study, many economists have come to recognize that when you give people in poverty money, they usually do smart things with it. They don't waste it.
So that answers the question of whether just giving cash can help people out of poverty. It can. Now the question has turned to how best to give people that money.
So yes, giving cash to people in poverty with no strings attached seems to work. Now, what's the best way to give people that cash?
One proposal is giving everyone in a community small amounts of money on a regular basis, say monthly. This is known as Universal Basic Income, or UBI. So economists are asking, if we want to help people out of poverty, is the UBI model a good way to do it?
One of the people interested in this question, Nobel Prize winning economist Abhijit Banerjee. I called him up to talk recently, but he was having a little trouble with our annoying recording setup and his headphones.
I'm actually not terrible at these things. It's just I have two headphones. If I can't make one of them work, I should be embarrassing.
You clearly have other strengths. If you've got a Nobel Prize, I don't think you have to beat yourself up for not being able to make the Bluetooth headphones work, you know?
Yes.
For many years, Abhijit had been interested in the question of how to help people out of poverty, and also in this idea of universal basic income. Then, several years after the GiveDirectly study from our original story, he was approached by the co-founder of GiveDirectly, an economist named Paul Niehaus, because Paul had an idea for a new research study.
Paul pitched it to me saying, you are interested in all these issues. Do you want to be involved in a UBI evaluation?
Abhijit was intrigued. Economists in a lot of different fields were interested in UBI as a better way to help poor people. But he felt this study could go further. For the study to be really useful, he thought, they would need to compare giving everyone in a village small regular monthly payments, like a UBI, against giving everyone one big lump sum all at once.
I was from the beginning saying, we need to benchmark it to a lump sum.
Why?
I thought one problem with UBI is that it's small amounts of money every month. And the problem is that people are finding it very difficult to save at home. And that was so, from the beginning, my concern is that, is this going to be too much of a challenge for these people to turn their small amounts into a larger amount, which they'll need to really start a business? So that was the very much the thinking behind the lump sum.
Was there a moment when you worried that the lump sum wasn't going to make it in amongst all these discussions?
I tend to be very, very, let's say, stubborn. So I was going to find that one out.
Eventually, Abhijit got his way. The study compares monthly and lump sum payments. In some villages, everyone got a lump sum of $500 all at once. In other villages, people got monthly payments of about $22 a month. First payments went out in 2018.
When they came to our village, they first walked all through the village.
This is Jane Martha Achieng Adongo. She remembers the first time GiveDirectly came to her small village. It's called Magawa. It's in western Kenya, on the plains, close to Lake Victoria. There's a lot of trees surrounding the village, a lot of farms. What's the noise in the background?
It's okay. They're just cows passing by. Okay. They're going to drink water in the lake.
Yeah, do not get in the way of that cow.
That cow wants its water. Now, when GiveDirectly came to the village, Jane Martha had a similar reaction to Bernard Amundi from our original story. She was skeptical.
When someone comes to the village and tells you that they're going to give you money, I did not believe. But the moment I received my first amount, I was very happy.
Jane Martha was in one of the monthly payments groups for the study, not the lump sum group. Now, she already had a small business that sold bread and clothes, but this new monthly payment allowed her to expand and sell more things.
Apart from the clothes, I am currently also selling plastics.
What kind of plastics?
I am selling plastic utensils I'm selling lunchbox. I'm also selling plastic chairs, and I'm also selling jugs.
And would that have been possible before these payments?
That was not possible.
The extra money helped her to also build a new house. It has three rooms, and it's a lot nicer than her old house. But for the purposes of Abhijit's study, there was one really interesting thing that Jane, Martha, and other people in her village did with their monthly payments.
When we started receiving money from Give Directly, there was a woman who came and approached us, 10 of us, to form a merry-go-round.
A woman in her village approached her about forming a merry-go-round, she said.
And when I say merry-go-round, what I mean is everyone contributes a certain amount of money every month from their transfers, and it's given to one person.
The people in the merry-go-round pool their money each month and give one big payment to one person in the group. Each month, a different person gets that big payment. In the end, Jane Martha got the same amount as her monthly payments, but as one big chunk. This is actually pretty common in areas without access to banks, because it's an effective way to save money.
The money is not as well. Merry-go-round is helping us to at least have a lump sum amount for you to be able to do something big at once.
So getting a bigger lump sum is more useful at times than getting a smaller monthly payment.
Yeah, getting money from a merry-go-round in lump sum is better for me.
And our economist and researcher, Abhijit Banerjee, found it wasn't just Jane Martha's village doing this. A lot of villages were turning their monthly payments, or their UBI payments, into lump sums.
That's beautiful. In a sense, that's the kind of thing when you see it, you say, okay, world makes sense.
At the beginning of the study, Abhijit had been concerned that the monthly payments wouldn't be as effective as lump sum payments in helping people out of poverty. And he was potentially right. But the participants in the study found a solution to that on their own.
They are doing what you would think you would do, which is, I really need 500 and I have 22. How do I get from 22 to 500? I put it in a merry-go-round. Eventually, it's going to be my turn. And when it does, I'm going to have my 500 and I'm going to build my new shop or whatever it is.
So the goal of Abhijit and his co-authors in this study was to figure out how effective a universal basic income could be, you know, getting regular monthly payments, and then to compare that to a lump sum.
We now have the results for the initial 2 years of the study. When it came to the villages getting the monthly payments, there were certain aspects where they performed better than the lump sum villages. There were lower incidences of depression, which makes some sense. Being certain that money is coming in regularly might relieve some stress.
And the results also addressed a fear some critics of UBI have, that people will get checks monthly and just stop working. The study showed a lot of participants did work less for other people. They instead started their own businesses and ended up working the same amount, but for themselves.
But overall, when it came to the question of which payment approach would lift more people out of poverty, at this point in time, the lump sum seems to be more effective, which is what Jane Martha told us. The researchers found that the villages where people received a lump sum payment, they started more businesses. Those businesses made more money, and people overall had higher incomes.
There is one more aspect of the study to share. There were actually two groups getting monthly payments, two different UBI groups. One group got payments for just 2 years. They were the short-term group. The other is going to keep getting them for a total of 12 years, the long-term group. And when Abhijit looked at the results of the first 2 years of the study,
what's striking is the short-term and the long-term don't look the same. They have each got 24 months of the same amount of money, but they are behaving entirely differently.
For 2 years, both groups got the same amount in the same way monthly. But just knowing that they'd be getting money for 12 years made the long-term group behave differently.
People getting short-term monthly payments experienced the least benefit of any group in the study. But people getting those long-term monthly payments, oddly, their results looked similar to the lump sum group. This was the group that Jane Martha was in. And like her, a lot of people in this group joined merry-go-rounds. They became planners. They saved their money. In short, they invested in their futures.
The program will end in 2030. Until then, Abhijit and other researchers will keep collecting data to try to answer what he calls the cosmic things. Big picture questions like, will the group of people receiving monthly payments keep saving? And will the positive results of the study persist even after the payments stop? Or will the participants wind up back where they started? The reporting for the first part of this episode was originally done for This American Life by Jacob Goldstein and David Kestenbaum.
Our show today was produced by Emma Peasley. It was edited by Jess Jang.
I'm Dave Blanchard.
And I'm Amanda Aronchik. This is NPR. Thanks for listening.
Okay, so Guy, you're here to tell us what's coming up next on How I Built This.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Dave. So today we're going to meet Jason Ballard. He's the co-founder of a company called Icon. It's a construction technology company that's developing a 3D printing platform that Jason believes might just hold the key to creating affordable housing.
What I hope to see in my own lifetime with my own eyes is the end of the global housing crisis. Because like right now, there's like a billion unsheltered people or under-sheltered people in the world. That's like people, like, my God, that's one out of seven or eight people.
Yeah.
And so we've really got to change the paradigm here. We've got to like curve jump to a different way of doing things.
Stick around after the break. It's How I Built This.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping public radio advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The Knight Foundation believes informed and engaged communities are essential for healthy democracy. More at kf.org. Coming up at 5.
The Nashville Parthenon is exactly what it sounds like, a replica of the real thing, but in Nashville. And there's a little-known museum below it with some pre-Columbian objects that were once stolen from Mexico.
They're somebody's history. They represent someone's ancestors, and we're not them.
Hear how the museum is working to return those artifacts on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Hello and welcome to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So a lot of places in the U.S. and in cities around the world are dealing with housing shortages. And these shortages are leading to all kinds of social and economic problems, things like really high home prices and even homelessness. Part of the problem is zoning, but the other part is the cost to build a house, especially with inflation. But imagine you could cut those costs by two-thirds or even more, and you could still build a great, high-quality, energy-efficient home. Well, this is what Jason Ballard set out to do. A few years ago, he started a company called Icon, and the idea was to use 3D printing technology to build houses. Fast forward to today, and the company has built dozens of these houses in Texas and in Mexico, with hundreds more in the planning stages. Now, before he launched Icon, Jason ran an eco-friendly building supply store called Treehouse with his college classmate Evan Loomis. But while Treehouse grew pretty quickly and has been largely successful, it wasn't long before Jason started to think about ways to make an even bigger impact.
At the time, it was more like, could Treehouse be doing more? You know, I was the CEO and founder of that company, and so that's where my focus was. And so I kind of made a list of things that I wanted to be true about the way that we build. I wanted to be sustainable. I wanted to be affordable. I wanted to be deployable at scale and with some speed. I wanted to be beautiful and sort of respecting human dignity. And eventually it was only 3D printing that like actually I believed had the possibility of checking all the boxes. Hmm. And so the first thing I did is I brought the idea to the board of directors of Treehouse. And I sort of explained all the research I had done, and I wanted us to invest in like a small amount of research and development to see if there was something here. And they said, Jason, that's, you know, we love your heart and we sort of respect what you're saying, but that is actually like not our business. Like we're a retail and services company. And so I went away for a quarter and I came back to the next board meeting and said, hey, I respect that, but I can't shake this idea and I would really like to pursue it. Do you mind if I work on this on nights and weekends? And this is actually a tricky question for your CEO because like sort of almost legally, all of your creativity and work belong to the company you're working for. So we actually drafted up paperwork that said, you know, like all of Jason's intellectual property and creativity belongs to Tress except when he's working on 3D printing. And so with the board's permission, I began on my own dime and my own time researching this kind of nights and weekends.
Okay, you're researching this idea. Like, could we 3D print a house, or could we 3D print homes that would tick all the boxes I need to tick? Environmentally sustainable, affordable, you know, beautiful, etc. And of course, 3D printing technology, you know, was coming online, and people were starting to even have little 3D printers at home.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the material used at that time and even now was plastic-based, right? You are thinking about, okay, can this be environmentally sustainable? So initially, what materials were you thinking that would be used to build these homes?
Yeah, I definitely initially thought you would want to use more conventional residential building materials. So like things related to the things I know that we can build houses out of. I had, as a person who'd been following and involved in like technologies for a bit, like I had long sort of suspected like there's some like misapplication of 3D printing technology, right? We were using it to make small things that were already mass produced very affordably. Like a lot of times people were 3D printing coffee mugs and spoons and stuff. It's like, we already have a lot of those and they're made really cheaply. It's like it occurred to me that like 3D printing would actually be super valuable when something was large, bespoke, and made very slowly. Mm-hmm. Like that would be an opportunity. And so a house is a perfect use case, right? Houses are quite large. They're constructed rather slowly over months and years, and they're very expensive. And so that would be an opportunity for 3D printing to actually make an improvement on the way that we build. And so I started working on that. And then I, you know, sort of called my old partner in crime, Evan Loomis, and he and I started meeting with anyone we could just to like learn fast. We took little classes on 3D printing. We ordered every book on 3D printing off of Amazon, started meeting with other 3D printing companies just to learn and soak up the knowledge really fast.
Wow. Let me ask you about a huge part of how you were going to make this happen, and that was concrete. You essentially land on this idea that concrete could be, this is before you figured out how, but you thought concrete probably is going to be the best material to use to 3D print a house. Now, it's interesting because concrete production, we've done this on the show, we've talked to people working on green cement and things like that, but still, as you know, it accounts for between 4% and 8% of carbon emissions. It is a carbon intensive material, right? And so you would think that like woods or wood polymers or things like that might be better for the environment. Tell me about concrete. Why did you land on concrete?
You know, luckily kind of having spent at that point, I had spent like over a decade in like sustainability and sustainability innovation. And I knew that sort of like the carbon that you're referring to is the carbon atmospherically released during the chemical reaction that produces Portland cement. That's the sort of that 4% to 8% stat you're quoting.
Yes, right.
But I knew that's not the whole story, right? There's also like the sort of operational carbon of like, how does the building perform? Because like, these are the issues we're fighting with stick built homes, right? Is that they're very energy inefficient. Like, you know, stick frame houses are, you have to insulate the heck out of them. So I knew enough about the situation to know like the carbon related to Portland cement production as an ingredient in concrete.
And Portland cement, for people who haven't heard our interviews on cement, is the most common type of cement used around the world.
Correct. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so it's an ingredient in almost every concrete used in the world. And so I knew that was probably problematic. So that's in the negative column. But in the positive column, you have almost certainly a more energy efficient house, almost certainly a more resilient house, almost certainly a more fireproof, moldproof, waterproof house, which are all sort of positives in the sustainability column. And so when you sort of did the whole accounting, sort of the life cycle accounting, there was a good argument to be made then and now that a house made of like more resilient, energy efficient materials on a life cycle actually would produce less carbon than one that was not.
I want to just kind of ask you about materials in homes, because most of us listening have drywall in our homes. It's like you have a wood frame house and they need to be insulated, and then the drywall is a form of insulation, but also it's very useful because you can nail things into it, you can tear it out, you can put it back in, you can put holes in it. I owned a home a few years ago. We had flooding from one of these atmospheric rivers in California, and 14 inches of drywall had to be cut out of the entire bottom floor of my house, and it's a pain. But you also, from what I read, have had some experiences with hurricanes. I think your childhood home was damaged by hurricane, and that was really devastating.
Exactly. That's true. I'm glad you picked up on that detail. So yeah, growing up on the Gulf Coast of Texas, my parents' home and my whole town, 95% of the town was substantially damaged in that hurricane.
This Hurricane Ike, I think, right?
Correct. And everyone in town had to tear out all of the interiors of their entire home, the floors, the drywall. It was very emotionally devastating and exhausting, disgusting work. And then I watched this put it right back together with the same materials that we had just seen in a very painful way are not fit to purpose for this environment.
Drywall.
Right. All these sort of unresilient materials.
Yeah.
Materials that are not suitable for almost any climate. If I offered you $1 million prize, or the whole audience listening to the show, $1 million prize to come up with a building material that could actually pass building code, that was more cheaply and poorly made than drywall, nobody would win the contest. It's literally the worst building material we have been able to invent.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, Jason makes his concrete printing idea a reality with the help of some sleepless nights and maxed out credit cards. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This.
Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. KQED Live and Litquake present A Night with Songwriter, a podcast that turns stories into songs featuring author Susan Orlean and songwriter Diana Gameros. June 13th, kqed.org/live, supported by Comcast Business.
Marine biologist Mara Hart studies the love lives of lobsters and all the seductive foreplay that happens before they finally mate.
For the next few hours, she will molt, so she sort of slips out of her shell, if you will. That whole time, the male guards over her.
Love Stories from the Ocean. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour at 4.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
Welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So it's 2017, and Jason, along with his wife and kids, are working on nights and weekends to build a 3D printer that can make homes out of concrete. And they're doing this as a side project while Jason is running his building supply company, Treehouse. And then an opportunity comes along.
And then eventually a customer emerges. Who has seen what we've done at Treehouse and says, if you guys could actually 3D print a house, we would have a project for you, but you have to prove that you could do it. Hmm. And that customer is a really innovative housing nonprofit called New Story. They came out of San Francisco. They went to the famous Y Combinator program. And the two co-founders found out about what we were doing and said, we agree that we need to innovate new ways to deliver affordable housing, and we're willing to take some risks. We were sort of founded as a risk-taking nonprofit. And if you guys can actually print a house, then we have a project for you in Mexico. And so then the game is on, right? And now it's suddenly myself, Evan, Alex, we then very quickly start spending a lot of money. I think I maxed out 3 credit cards.
Huh. Okay, so you're spending money like crazy, money you don't really have, to build this prototype of a 3D printed home made almost entirely from concrete. And how big was this home going to be?
In the like neighborhood of like 500 square feet was the initial target.
Okay, so like a large hotel room, basically.
Yeah, like a studio home or like an accessory dwelling unit sort of scale thing.
So how did you come up with the material that could build this prototype house?
We had some smart friends and advisors, and like we were just doing just good enough, right? Like material we used then passed every single test that the city of Austin and every permitting authority and the structural engineers threw at us. But it's not the material we use today, so we've continued to improve. So we got it good enough. But you wouldn't have known that for sure at the start of the project, right? I mean, it was,
yeah.
As a matter of fact, we got halfway through the house, and we were buying sort of the concrete as a dry mix, like a dry powder. And it was dewy in the mornings, and the bags were sitting out there on the job site, and it ruined a bunch of the bags of the concrete. And then we, like, last minute had to order more concrete because we had already announced that we were going to be unveiling something special at South By. So the clock is running. And so we were out of money, all my credit cards. So I called my wife and said, Jenny, I think we are going to finish this house, but I actually have to go get another credit card, and I'm going to immediately max it out. And she did not bat an eye. She was like, this is so important, Jason. Like let's go. like we're in this together. I mean, her whole energy and enthusiasm was like, of course, dummy. Like, that's why we're married. And so we got one more credit card, immediately maxed it out on a concrete order, and finished printing the house like 48 hours before we unveiled it at South by Southwest.
Wow. So now you've got this house, and it was a big splash. I think at the time, the coverage of it said it was built, it was printed in a day at a cost of $4,000. It wasn't entirely correct. I mean, it took a little bit longer than just a day to make, but...
Yeah. That's exactly correct. Probably the accurate way to say, like, I had it printed perfectly, it could have printed in 24 hours. That got lost,
yeah,
in all the headlines.
Right.
But it did not account for, like, the windows and the walls and all that new. That was a lesson that enforced its own penalty. For the next several years, we got, like, nonstop calls of people trying to order $4,000 houses.
$4,000 homes, yeah.
And it was like, by God, I am going to speak much more clearly in the future. But at the time, you have to understand also, like, we hadn't slept in days. We didn't even know if it would work until 48 hours before. All of a sudden, we won the South by Southwest Startup Showcase. There were, like, press and people crawling all over and, like, sticking microphones in my face and asking questions. And they're like, how much did it cost to print? And I didn't have the presence of mind or the thoughtfulness.
But still, it cost, I mean, even if it cost $10,000, it was a remarkable achievement.
Yeah, that's right. It was a remarkable achievement. And it became the basis that we were then able to raise money and start a real company.
So on the strength of that, you were able not only to raise money, but you had this promise from this nonprofit, this Y Combinator-backed nonprofit called New Story, to work with them. I guess they wanted to build inexpensive, resilient homes in a poor part of Mexico. And this is going to be your first project, I should mention, right?
That's right. It's going to be our first sort of scaled project. Now, what happened between them is New Story was very proud and excited, like ready to, let's pack it up and go, let's go to Mexico. And we said, actually, like, that was rather painful. There's a few changes we would like to make to the printer. For instance, the pumping system completely crapped out. And like, it never worked. And so we were actually, like, with buckets hand loading the printer. So our joke to this day is like, it was an artisan 3D printed house. And so we sort of said, hey, if we could have a little bit more time, there's some, like, real upgrades we would like to make before we head down to Mexico.
And you needed this constructed for you, like, custom built for you, this printer.
Oh, everything about this is custom. Yeah, that's exactly right. New Story says, yeah, of course, yeah, make the upgrades. And so we raise money, a few million dollars, and use that money to hire other engineers, hire help, hire proper material scientists, lease some space. And we get to work sort of doing like a version two.
I mean, let's talk about this project in Mexico, in Tabasco. How many houses were they, was New Story financing?
It was a pilot project of 10 homes.
Okay. And this was going to be your first large scale project. How long did it take you to build those 10 homes?
It took sort of the whole project from like shipping down there, getting set up, finding local concrete providers, et cetera. It took about a year to do the whole project.
And now people live there.
Yeah, now people live there. And it feels like to so quickly go from like a dream to like real impact in the world is like, man, if this thing went bankrupt today, I'm already pretty proud of what we've done.
Wow. All right. So it's 2019. And you guys have successfully built a community of these 3D printed studio homes in Mexico. And I guess now you're starting to sort of get flooded with requests from, you know, particularly American developers who want to partner with you. At that time, how did you decide which projects to say yes to?
Yeah, so after we got back from Mexico, we did one quick little project with an innovative developer group called Three Strands. And the focus of, so every project in the early days had like a real purpose, like a box we wanted to check or something we wanted to prove to the world.
Yeah.
And what we wanted to prove with that project with Three Strands is that you could, because at that time everybody's like, oh yeah, those are tiny homes for homeless people. It's not really going to help the global housing crisis, all these sorts of things. And so we felt like it was time to prove that we could build a house of sufficient quality and beauty that a working class American would buy it. You could get a mortgage on it, sort of all those things. That was sort of the goal of that project. So we did four homes on 17th Street in East Austin. And
what was the cost of each finished home?
So all four were different sizes. I think the cheapest of them was like in the $400,000 range, and the most expensive was like in the $700,000 or $800,000 range, if memory serves me correctly. It's sort of like plus or minus the median house price in Austin, right? And so that was a huge success for us, right? That, you know, you believe in what you're doing, of course, but will people actually put several $100,000 commitment is real belief, right? People are making like decisions about their lives and with real resources. And one thing that was beginning to eat us at that moment was, you know, people were pointing to homes they knew and asking us to 3D print those homes.
Homes that, like what, like Frank Lloyd Wright style homes? Or?
No, like you just rather some of the homes you're used to, they're squares, like squares and and rectangles. Right. But it's like,
yeah,
there's all these opportunities to do like some really innovative things with 3D printing, things, opportunities around aesthetics, but also
like curved walls and just like crazy.
Yeah.
Funky.
You got things that look expensive, but are the same price to print as a straight line.
Right.
But also some of those things can add real strength and energy performance, right? If I have a straight piece of paper, if we had a video and I stood the paper up a follower, but if I bent the paper, it would stand up with no additional reinforcement or material changes. So that sense that like shape can create strength, there's all these opportunities that would add no cost to a building, but that 3D printing gives you for free, but people didn't really know how to imagine or think about it. So we realized we couldn't like wait on the world to innovate for us. We needed to show the world what 3D printing made possible. And so we did a sort of purposefully high-end, experimental kind of avant-garde house that we called House Zero, that we unveiled that following year. It was like a bomb going off in the same year we sold homes at market rate that were 3D printed and showed that an entirely new architecture and design language is possible with 3D printing.
So you basically proved this out, and I know you went on to attract a lot more interest from investors, and I think to date you've raised over $450 million because this is a big, ambitious project. Just as you were really kind of hitting your stride, you had a pretty big setback. A fire really damaged your main facility.
Yeah. The fire happened on Black Friday, like the morning after Thanksgiving. Like at 2 or 3 in the morning, I get a call that like the HQ's on fire. Mm. Had it happened at any other moment, it would have wiped out the entire company. For a long time, that was our only building. And all of our printers, everything we had was in that building. But we had just opened a second building that we were using as like a factory to make the printers. So almost the entire fleet, except for one test printer, was out of the building because it was a holiday. No humans were in the building. And so we ended up, the losses were like largely sentimental. Like I had like the very first printer that printed that Chacon house is in that building and melted into a pile of aluminum slag. And it was sort of like the Wright Brothers airplane getting burned up.
Yeah.
And so I still treasure those things in my heart. But the things that we needed to keep moving, we still had. We still had the fleet. We still had the people.
Yeah.
All the software was in the cloud. And we were like back to work on Monday morning.
Wow. Okay. So shortly after that, you were awarded a contract from NASA. And this is a completely different part of your business that you're now focused on. They essentially want you to one day 3D print structures on the moon. So this is real. Like, there's a timeline. There's an expectation that you're going to do this maybe within 10 years.
Oh, I mean, that would be way too long. It better be sooner than that. Yeah, we got a contract to develop a construction system as part of the Moon to Mars program. So it's a construction system that's supposed to be for the moon, but should also be easily repurposed for Mars. That's the sort of the actual contract. You know, the new Artemis program, which is kind of like the successor, at least the spiritual successor to the Apollo program from the 60s, wants to return to the moon. But this time it's like, we want to return to the moon to stay. And when you want to go and stay, you need things like power and life support systems, but you also need like lots of infrastructure, landing pads, roads, habitats, shelters. And so we've actually got to be able to build on other worlds. And this has actually been on ICON's radar from the very beginning, but it was always a belief that this is like a tool that needs to be in humanity's toolkit of the way that we build and construct things. And these advanced tools make all kinds of things possible. They will help us solve big problems on Earth. They will help us pursue really cool opportunities on Earth, like domes and arches and vaults and all these kind of incredible ways of building and designing that, like, we don't think are on the menu right now. But one of the cool things it makes possible is building in space and on other worlds. And my belief is that these things all go together. Hmm. We've been stick framing homes for hundreds or even 1,000 years. And it's not like we're going to discover some secret breakthrough in stick framing homes that's going to allow us to solve homelessness. Mm. If we keep doing what we've been doing, then we're going to get what we've got, and what we got ain't working. And so I think it will be the tools of an advanced civilization that let us solve some of these like very difficult and thorny problems. And so I think it may just turn out that the answers to some of our problems on Earth are going to be found on the moon.
Hmm. So, I mean, you know, as you know, I mean, there's an affordability crisis in many cities. You're in Austin. That's a place where that crisis exists. I'm in north of San Francisco. You know, massive, massive problems here with homelessness and unhoused folks. I mean, you are talking about something that can really be stood up quickly and can be done affordably. And so let's just talk about homelessness for a moment. I mean, I imagine that there are lots of organizations and groups like the one you worked with in Mexico that have approached you and have said, look, can we do this? Can we build like villages for people to house them? Tell me about those conversations or that interest that you've had, if at all.
Yeah, we definitely have them. And in fact, like, we'll have hundreds of more homes for the very poor and the homeless coming online in the near term future. That continues to be like a very important part of the work of ICON. Homelessness is a complex issue, having worked at a homeless shelter.
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah. It's not just about putting people in homes. That's right.
But it will never be less than putting people in homes. It will at least be putting people in homes. And yeah, there's probably more that we need beside that. And it seems like we have evaded, you know, housing is a necessary but often insufficient resolution to homelessness.
Yeah.
But it will always be necessary, and it will never be less than housing. And it has been amazing how much like the obvious thing of like innovate around building and then build your brains out as like an important first step. Whatever services have to be layered on top of that, it will always have to at least be shelter. What I hope to see in my own lifetime with my own eyes is the end of the global housing crisis, defined as a crisis of housing availability, housing affordability, and housing sustainability. If you could get to where you're building 1 million homes a year, it would still take you 1,000 years to build a billion shelters. And that's like 950 years too long. And so we've really got to change the paradigm here. We've got to like curve jump to a different way of doing things.
That's Jason Ballard, co-founder and CEO of ICON. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the show this week. You've just heard an excerpt, and if you want to hear the full episode of How I Built This, you can find the show wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Carla Estevez, with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. It was edited by John Isabella. This hour of Planet Money and How I Built This was produced by Carrie Thompson. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. With AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR. From Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to